Good evening. I'm Bishop Brian Wallace, and my lovely wife is there in the back. We're delighted to be here with you today, and I think it's true that the very first Anglican service I ever attended was at Church of the Savior in the late 90s. I'm here to perform as a bishop an ordination and some confirmations, and the passage that the Lord has given me to prepare for these services is one that's really important to me and really close to my heart, Psalm 131. And I need to tell you that I might get emotional a couple of times in this, and that's okay, you can handle that, right?
I cry half the time.
I'm glad to hear that. And the reason is because my very first encounter with this wonderful psalm took place about 28 years ago. I was a young senior leader in an InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. I think the youngest in the country in an up-and-coming region, one with lots of needs, but also some movement. I had come to restart the work in Texas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas, and things were on the move. I thought I was on the move. I had lots of questions, lots of burdens, lots of dreams and work for myself, and my boss had come to town, and we were going to spend an entire day together at a friend's lake house, and where I hoped he was going to mentor me, teach me, help me develop my skills so I could go from good to great, get wisdom that I needed to be the leader I thought I was. I had set my sights pretty high. By the way, that boss was Mr. Doug Stewart. As soon as we got to the lake house, however, Doug sat me down on a chair on the back porch. It was a beautiful day. And handed me a single sheet of paper with the words of Psalm 131 on it. He said, "Read this for a while. I'm going for a walk. I'll be back in a couple of hours." I had 2 hours to read and reread the shortest psalm in the Bible. He came back and we discussed it over lunch. And then he repeated the pattern 2 more times. I was alone with this psalm for about 6 hours that day. And I got a friend confess, Doug knows, I didn't get it. I was mad. I was frustrated. On the way back to my home, I became cross and argumentative with Doug. I said, "Hey, I needed training and leadership. I need you to help me become the best I can be. Why did we waste the day reading 3 verses in the Bible?" I was hurt, you see. I was deeply worried that I would miss my chance to learn how to be a great leader, because that's what I thought I was supposed to be about. I certainly wasn't still or quiet. But Doug listened to me with patience and with love. He wasn't defensive or argumentative. He listened to my soul's cry, because that's what it was. And when I was done with my venting and my wrestling, because that's what it was too, he simply put his arm on my shoulder and said, "Brian, I'm not worried about you as a leader. I think you'll know what to do when the time comes. But I'm very worried about your soul." So Doug, with kind of expert love that you know he has, and with the tender leadership, used this psalm to invite me into, I can't even read my own words. Doug invited me into a way of not just caring for my own soul differently, but into a reframing of what I thought life was about in ministry. And that framing, I think, may have saved my life. It certainly saved me from myself and from my ambition and from my constant wrestling, my striving, and my anxiety. And so this evening, Sarah, and you confirmands, I want to talk about the psalm and what the invitation might be to us to set yourself within this story that this psalm is giving us, so that we can take our place in the very story of God as we really are, so we can take our place in the rest of God that is offered to us, and so we can put our hope in God himself. The rest of God, the story of God, and the hope of God is what I want to talk to you about this evening. I'm not going to make it through, but bear with me. This psalm starts with the first verse. O Lord, my heart is not lifted up. My eyes are not raised too high. I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvelous for me. Now, many translations render the first verse, my heart is not proud. And we read it earlier today. It says, O Lord, I am not proud. Now, you know what we say about people who say they are not proud? No humble person would ever deny they have at least some pride in their life. It's like my youngest son when he was a toddler. He was in the back seat of the car, and invariably he would cry out, I'm not tired. We knew. 30, 40 seconds at most, he'd be dead asleep. We'd be riding in the car, and he would give himself away. Now, it doesn't make sense to declare in prayer, I am not proud. My heart is not lifted up. So what's going on? I think this is not the psalmist declaring a state of being as much as it is a decision to choose a way of being. When we pair the first half of the verse with the second, we begin to understand what's happening. I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvelous for me, the psalmist says. Now, the psalmist is admitting here that there are things that are beyond him, things that are beyond his pay grade, so to speak. Again, it's a decision to a certain way of life, one that chooses to let God be God, and to take our place in the world that is in keeping with the most important truths in the entire universe. Things like God's creator and I'm a creation. God is all powerful and I'm limited. I'm temporal, but God is eternal. To pray this psalm is to decide to let God be God, to let him run the universe and to let him run my life, to let him provide for me day by day. It's to take my right place in the story. I'm not creator. I'm not God. I'm a creation. I'm under God. He gets to decide how my life goes and where I am. It's a decision to follow Jesus as a disciple and let him be Lord. It's to enter the story and take our place in it. It's a decision not to set my sights on things that are beyond my grasp, because God's the only one who can and should reach that far. Eugene Peterson renders this first verse in a way that I think brings emphasis to this decision. He writes it, God, I'm not trying to rule my roost. I don't want to be king of the mountain. I haven't meddled where I have no business or fantasized grandiose plans. You see, in the story of God, we're always children, loving to a loving, powerful Father, and we take our place not to rule the universe, but to let him rule it for us as our kind and good Father. You and I have no business trying to run the universe or run our neighborhood or run our families. It's too much for us. And by the way, running those things is not our place in the story, like I've said. But it gets complicated when we understand this psalm was written by who? King David. What's beyond the pay grade of a king? If he doesn't think he should think too highly of himself or involve himself in weighty matters, what business do any of us have in involving ourselves into anything God might be doing? But friends, the psalm's not an invitation to passivity. The decision to take our place in the world under God is not to abandon our roles or our callings in the world. We're called to be God's hands and feet in the world, right? To feed the poor, clothe the naked, visit the prisoner, protect the widow, and visit the orphan. We are still called to put our hands to the duties and tasks and engagements of our various callings, but we're not to run the universe. That's God's job, and he's been doing it well before any of us were here, and should he not come again soon enough, he will be doing it when we're all gone. We may not understand what God is doing. We may not like what we think God seems to be doing. But I'm not going to run the roost. I'm not going to try to concern myself with things that only God can really do and what only he can comprehend. It's too great. It's too marvelous for me. But that's hard to do really practically, isn't it? How do we go about living our lives and being faithful to our callings in the world without overstepping our bounds? I think it helps us, friends, to understand how the Hebrew person understood the nature of a day. So for thousands of years, the Hebrew culture considered the day to begin when the sun went down. our basic understanding is the opposite. It's the day when the day begins is when the sun comes up, or when my alarm clock goes off and I exert agency in the world. Think about the mindset if we shift our understanding to the day beginning at sunset. The day does not begin with my activity, not with my agency, my energy in the world. No, the day begins and I go to bed. It's like saying, God does, I am not the most important thing in the world. In fact, God doesn't need me to make the world spin. The day will begin with my inactivity, and the God who never sleeps will be at work ruling and reigning in the world, and he'll start the day without needing my help. But that doesn't mean our work is unimportant. It just means that we are not, and our work is not primary in the world. That's not our part of the story. God gets to be primary. And the Hebrew concept of the day holds so much dignity and value for our participation in the work of God in the, around us. It's the unfolding of his rule and reign in the world, and we simply wake up into the invitation to join him in it, to take our place lovingly, joyfully, freely into his will and his way. Now, admit, that's really a countercultural way of living, isn't it? You won't find this invitation in any of the business journals, self-help books, or Instagram followers you might subscribe to. The advice of the world is seize the day, exert your power, take charge of your life. You go, queen, you go. Was that me? Peterson says it this way, what is described in Scripture is basic sin, the sin of taking things into our own hands, being our own God and grabbing what is there when you can get it, is now described by our culture as basic wisdom. But David, the author of the psalm, was a king. He had to wake up each morning and make decisions that influenced the political, social, religious, and family life of every person in the nation, and you could argue in the nations around him. Again, the psalm wasn't an invitation to the passivity we might think taking our place in the story means. But the psalm is David's reminder to himself that while king, he's not God. It's a check on his ego, his ambitions, and his runaway dreams of the self. Friends, I think that's why Doug asked me to read this psalm. I needed that check on my life. And friends, this psalm, and Sarah, this psalm is an invitation to humility. There's a way of going about our life under God and for God rather than ourselves. That's our place in the story. Place of dignity and joy and freedom and rest. The balance is hard. Maintaining a proper relationship to my work and my calling while not overstepping my bounds is for me a daily struggle. In part because I really care about the things I get to do. Now as a bishop, I care about our churches. I care about our clergy. I care about the things that are going on in the world around me. There are issues in the world that really matter. Sometimes reminding myself that I'm not God is not enough to curb my appetite for success. I'm a 3 on the Enneagram. I'm addicted to success. Doug saw that from a million miles away. I crave that feel-good sense of being noticed and praised. I think sometimes we all do. So for me, in this moment, for the next step is getting quiet so I can let God be God. That is the true for the psalmist too. He says again, my heart's not lifted up. My eyes aren't too haughty. I don't occupy myself with things too great for me or marvelous for me. So I've calmed and quieted my soul. Like a weaned child with its mother, like a weaned child is my soul within me. Now, calm and quiet don't come naturally in my world. How about you? There's nothing really naturally calm about my family, my job, my commute. My commute is almost always on a plane, and there's always a rookie in the TSA line right in front of me. Taking off their shoes. Come on. What are you doing? All of life seems to awaken my inner infant. How about you? My soul gets noisy, unsettled, and fussy sometimes. It takes work to get quiet. It takes work to be able to hear the things that are most important in the world. For most people, it's the deliberate choice that happens with planning, with care and decision. It's a discipline, a spiritual discipline. Now, in my doctoral research, I studied exemplar leaders who had their lives together full of life and flourishing in Christian ministry. And it was fascinating that of all the people that I studied, there was only one specific spiritual discipline that was common to all my research subjects. What do you think it was? They took regular retreats. Part of their habit as leaders, their discipline in the world, was to remove themselves from their daily activity, to literally put the world on mute so they could cultivate the ability to hear the voice of Jesus. It's very hard to be quiet while holding a noisy phone that's constantly begging for your attention, sending you messages about your relative value in the world. And friends, that's exactly what it's doing all day, every day. It's also impossible with a constant barrage of Fox News or CNN blaring from your television telling you what to believe. We need to silence the world and its messages about our values and security, where your friends from the world are all rooted in lies. Quiet and calm are not ignorant of the real issues in the world. They simply do not let the world around them determine what's important, what's valuable, or true. I think this is the core challenge of discipleship, fundamental to our relationships to God, learning how to be quiet, to let God order and define what is true around us. And I think Jesus talks about what we call the parable of the soils. Remember that story? There are four kinds of soils. There's the hard pan soil where the word sits on it. The birds can steal it away right away. There's the rocky soil where the seed sprouts up and but it can't withstand the temptations because there's rockiness and not enough soil, so it withers in the sun. And then there's the fourth soil, the one where the seed sprouts up and produces an amazing crop, 30, 60, 100 times what was planted. But then there's that other soil. We call it sometimes the third soil, the weedy soil, where the plant grows up among the weeds. It still lives. It still produces a crop. But the real fruitfulness is choked out in competition with the weeds. I think that soil describes almost every one of us in this room. It's endemic to American Christianity. Jesus' commentary in the weedy soil is that the cares of this world, the deceitfulness of wealth, and the desire for other things choke out our lives and make it unfruitful. The cares of this world, the deceitfulness of wealth, and the desire for other things are loud in my life. They're probably loud in your life too. Like I was 28 years ago when I wanted more leadership, more skill, more notice, more place, more capacity. We all wrestle with it in some ways, in our unique ways. We get unsettled, fussy, and certainly not quiet. Now, it doesn't take a careful reading of the word to know that the author of this psalm wrestled with these things too. He struggled with his family. He struggled with temptations, with the weight of all of his work, and yet he chose to cultivate a life of quiet, of stillness. It's the grown-up confidence of a relationship with God. See, the picture of the weaned child is not that we stay small, dependent, and infantile. Rather, it's the picture of a person who can now be at peace enough to enjoy a relationship with their parent, confident the parent knows what is needed and loving enough to provide it. Food, clothing, meaning, value, place in the world, belonging. It's the picture of seek first the kingdom, and all this will be added to you as well. The invitation to a still and quiet heart is to let God be in charge of the very real cares, concerns, and troubles in the world and in our lives, and in a way that cultivates greater relationship and intimacy with God himself. Arthur Weiser says it this way, that this person is now has no desire comes between you and your God, for you're sure that God knows what you need before you ask him. And just as the child gradually breaks off the habit of regarding the mother only as a means of satisfying his desires and learns to love her for her own sake, so the worshiper now learns to desire God for himself and not as a means of a fulfillment of his own wishes. His life's center of gravity has shifted. He now rests no longer in himself, but in God. It's a picture of a child at rest, secure, with all their needs provided by a loving parent who will protect them and care for them. A weaned child can now say no to the cares of the world. I can get involved, but they're not mine to fix. I can say no to the deceitfulness of wealth. I will simply be content with what I have. I can order my desires so that I'm no longer driven to achieve, to attain, or to control. I'm now ultimately free to put my hope in something worthy of my life, God Himself, in His never-failing love. Friends, the psalm is not an invitation to passivity. I've said that before. It's not where we don't put our hands to the duties, tasks, and engagements of our various callings. The invitation, friends, the promise is that we can do it with rest, with confidence and peace of one whose hope is in the Lord, who loves us more than we can ask or imagine. Again, Peterson says it this way, that Psalm 131 nurtures a quality of calm, confidence, and quiet strength that knows the difference between unruly arrogance and faithful aspiration, knows how to discriminate between infantile dependency and childlike trust, and chooses to aspire to trust. Friends, I got to tell you, 28 years ago, Doug knew I needed to discern the difference between unruly arrogance and faithful aspiration. And he taught my heart how to hope and how to rest and take my story place in the story of God. And in the midst of my life, with all of its cares and concerns, with all its duties and burdens, I've learned to still and quiet my soul. God's got this. God's got me. I will trust Him. For David, I think this was served as a literal 30-second reminder to himself that he wasn't alone, that there was something more important, someone more powerful than the challenges that he faced. Again, I think this is exactly why David wrote this psalm. Something small, something short that he could carry around with him in the day. A mini retreat, so to speak, from the cares of the world and the siren call of wealth and the constant desires for things other than Jesus. And now 28 years ago, that's what this psalm has become for me. It's always with me. I carry it with me everywhere. It's in my heart. It's when I feel anxious. It's a touchstone that connects me back to the very real love of the Father. I'm making choices not to reach too far. I'm making choices to be quiet and trust that I'm a child of God, dearly loved. And I remind myself that I have a hope that is worth all of my trust. And so as we close this sermon, would you join me in prayer? Turn to page 10 in your program. And we're going to take a 30-second retreat together and pray this psalm together. Join me in prayer, would you? O Lord, I am not proud. I have no haughty looks. I do not occupy myself with great matters or with things that are too hard for me. But I still my soul and make it quiet. Like a child upon its mother's breast, my soul is quieted within me. O Israel, wait upon the Lord from this time forth forevermore. Would you take a moment just to sit and ask the Lord what He might be saying to you this evening?